Muller House Meeting, Friday, 22nd September 1978. Yesterday, we considered absolute consciousness or pure consciousness in terms of the primordial creative energy. We may well use this phrase in modern times because the meaning of the word energy has changed so radically, and it has become so deep that if we penetrate into it carefully, we can well equate it with whatsoever is transcendent. Whatever name you like to use. In past ages, the transcendent was regarded in purely personalistic terms, as a being. And then, as the centuries passed, conceptions which were of a more philosophical nature, using philosophical language, with regard to the transcendent, came into being. Today, it is the age of science. And science has progressed so wonderfully far, especially in the way in which it has dissolved the barrier between the meanings of the word material and immaterial. So that we have bridged right across that gap which was impassable till the beginning of our century. And if we are sufficiently sensitive, and more, if we are sufficiently perceptive, inwardly perceptive, then we may well equate the primordial creative energy with pure consciousness, with transcendence. Now, we cannot consider consciousness without considering mind. Everyone in the world uses the word mind. What is mind? Do we ever try to investigate what exactly or reasonably exactly we call mind? And yet we use that word every day of our lives. All of us, whoever we are, educated, not educated, advanced, backward, we refer to my mind, as we call it. Now, what is mind? You may remember yesterday I lightly touched upon the fact that pure consciousness, or the primordial creative energy, which is unitary, single, whole, complete in itself, manifests itself in certain main ways, some of which are accessible to man. Only some of them are accessible to us because we ourselves have our limitations. When we ourselves reach our complete fruition in terms of the fulfillment of the purpose of our existence on this globe, then too we shall still be limited in relationship to the immensity of the totality. So, we can go only thus far. Now we may regard mind as that archetypal, that is universal form or way of energy, of the primordial creative energy which releases cosmos into being. It is the great structurer, that which produces the structure. Now, in producing structure, it does so by self-limitation. Because if there is no self-limitation, definite structure cannot emerge. It is just one undifferentiated totality. If you were the only person in the entire universe and you looked around, you'd see nothing. So this structuring implies a certain degree of self-limitation of the primordial creative energy. And in its aspect, which we may call the universal, the divine, or the supreme mind, it brings cosmos into being. Now, this energy, when it meets with what is manifested in the cosmos, gives rise to many things. What does it give rise to in us, ourselves, human beings? Now, the body, as we say, is material. It's composed of solids, liquids, gases. It is material. It has, the living body has a structure in which the brain, the nervous system, the ductless glands and the bloodstream play a very important part. The total activity of the living body, we may say, is an electrochemical, or if you like, a physico-chemical process. It's our electrochemical energy, which, functioning as it does through the living body, produces so many phenomena. But the body itself, this which we call the material body, is derived in its substance from the material of the cosmos. The same elements, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, iron, silver, phosphorus, gold, and so on, all these are the primordial atoms, if you like, the original atoms, which compose this body as such. So, this body is part of the universal body with this particular structure and with this particular mode of functioning. Now, picture mind, the universal energy pervading the cosmos, interacting with the body. And that energy, when rooted in the brain, a part of it is rooted in the brain, the nervous system, the Douglas glands and all their activity, that gives rise to all our mental processes. Now, it is rather useful to approach the idea of mind in that manner. Because after all, to use the phrase my mind is absurd. You can't call the universal mine. It isn't mine. It possesses me, but I cannot possess it. And if it is universal, indescribable, unimaginable as an energy, how can I appropriate a bit of it and call it mine? But if this energy, the universal mentality, shall we say, interacts with the universal corporeality, the bodiness of the universe, in terms of man gives rise to his particular psyche. So it is useful to use the word psyche in that sense. Because the psychical functioning of each single person is his particular functioning. It is quite characteristic of that particular man. So you and I can legitimately say, my psyche. But it is wise not to say, my mind. The day can come when the psyche has come to fruition so wonderfully, so perfectly, that the person is truly the whole human being, then his psyche is completely in tune with the universal psyche, with the universal mind. Now you can see what happens. This being so, the meaning of a phrase like the Unio Mystica becomes full of light and significance and real, true meaning. Otherwise, there is an element of mystification about the union with God, or as the Upanishads put it, realizing the Atma, or becoming Brahman. When you use phrases like that, a man will say, but this is the height of spiritual pride. This cannot be true. How can the man declare that he is one with God? The whole idea of the deification of man is an idea which has been considered by the masses and by very advanced people too as a blasphemous idea. But now if we look at it this way, we will begin to see light in this idea of the deification. And even in Christian mysticism, with people like St. Bernhard, for instance, deification was taught, was clearly expressed. Dionysius the Areopagite also expressed that. Men like Eckhart, Ruysbroeck, suggested it very, very strongly, but very carefully, because otherwise they would have suffered at the hands of the church. You see? But in the other great religions, the mysticisms belonging to the other great religions have that idea quite freely. Even Islam, in some of its mystical presentations. So now, we get a perception of the nature of mind in its universal aspect and of the psyche in its individual personal aspect. Now, how are we conscious of our psychical functioning? We are conscious of it in terms of feelings, perceptions, volitions, and the activity of our personal discriminative consciousness. It is important to use the word discriminative, because if you watch your consciousness process, you will find that essentially it is occupied with discriminating between this and that and the other. And it functions, therefore, in terms of limitation throughout our ordinary everyday life. There comes the time when that limitation can be transcended, and it functions both ways, universally as well as in terms of the particular. In terms of the immortal and of eternity, and also in terms of mortality and time. But that, of course, is the culmination of man's development. Now you may ask, I have mentioned feelings, perceptions, volitions, and discriminative consciousness. But what of the body itself? Is it material in the sense of an objective materiality which subsists, comes into being, and changes in its own rights? We may find that if we examine the situation carefully, our consciousness process, that we are conscious of the body through our sensuous functioning, meaning thereby through the functioning of our sight, hearing, touch, taste, and all the senses. In fact, a Buddhist philosophy talks of sight consciousness, hearing consciousness, touch consciousness, taste consciousness, and also a type of mind consciousness, which is concerned, of course, and observes our thinking, feeling process, our intellectual, emotional process. So you see, if this were absent, the body would mean nothing to us. So we may regard the body also not so much as a substantial body made of substance in its own rights, but as a constituent of consciousness. If there was no mind, if there was no psyche, or shall I say, no psycho-mentality, there'd be no body as far as we are aware. That is to say, the body as the body would be there, but there wouldn't be the wholeness of our psycho-physical being and functioning. It would be a peculiar and an impossible to conceive situation. On the other hand, if there is no body, just this material body which the scientist can investigate, there'd be no such thing as the psyche, no such thing as a mental process. Have you ever met a psyche or a mind walking down the street? Or have you ever met a body which was completely devoid of psyche or mind? No, the two are there together. But because we as human beings function essentially through our psychical mechanism, therefore it would make more sense in the long run to think of body also as part of the constituent of consciousness itself, which manifests as feelings, volitions, perceptions, etc. You see? Therefore, let us use a term like shape or form rather than the term body, because body is so much associated in our minds with materiality that the more important part of our developmental process, which is concerned with our psychical coming to maturity and to the state of perfect health, of perfect purity, we are essentially concerned with that in our evolution and development. Nature brings the material, what we commonly call the material body, to maturity. But the psyche becomes our internal responsibility. Nature stops with the external and then hands over to us and says, now, you are a self-conscious being, you have the power to look within yourself and observe your psychical processes and make the psyche also equally mature and perfect. equally healthy with the body. That is our personal responsibility. Therefore, the whole process of the development of our souls, as we may say, or of the spirit, is a question of paying the greatest attention to all our psychical functioning. A psychical functioning which includes also the functioning of the body. Hence the necessity to take very great care of the body, because the psyche has its concrete physical roots in the brain, the nervous system, and the ductus glands particularly. Now this is very important in order that we may understand something of our real nature and constitution and how it works. Now, I mentioned discriminative consciousness. This discriminative consciousness is a reflection of absolute or pure consciousness. We mustn't identify our discriminative consciousness with that pure consciousness. Discriminative consciousness constantly differentiates, that is, it separates out, it analyzes all that comes within the sphere of its life activity. And therefore, what we do every day of our lives is to split the whole world up into little bits of which we are conscious. And we think of them, we feel about them, we act in relation to them as separate little bits. So that vast background, the totality, the entire cosmos, pure consciousness itself, the primordial creative energy, which is our real living, continual, perpetual background, does not play its right, a sufficiently important part in our discriminative consciousness and its activities. We are somewhat blind to reality in its fullness. And most of us perhaps may be considerably blind to it. And that is why the world is in this great state of ignorance, of bondage, and of suffering. Now, because we cannot see the harmony of the whole, single reality, our psyche is in a state of turmoil. Because the functioning of the psyche is unable to take into account the relationships between all the different parts of the world into which we have split up the world in our consciousness. And this turmoil, this disturbance of the psyche, is like the stormy waves on the ocean, whereas the depths of the ocean are calm and peaceful. They are in a state of peace. They are in a state of the complete fulfillment of the law of their existence. But it is the surface of the ocean where the storms rage and the disturbances and difficulties, and in psychical terms, our pains and pleasures, our joys and sorrows, all take place. When our discriminative consciousness, through intense mindfulness, watchfulness, and pure observation, begins to penetrate into the depths of this ocean which underlies the psyche, then we see the truth of things in relationship to the whole. Then comes harmony from within in our own lives, and peace and true prosperity, spiritual prosperity, which is the source of the right kind of what we call material prosperity. Now, a word about this word which we use, seeing. I say that when our discriminative consciousness succeeds in penetrating into the depths, then we see the truth of things. In the ordinary way, what the world means by saying, oh, we see that this is true, they only mean a superficial perception. I, the separate subject, am looking at that, a separate object, and I form a mental picture about it, which may or may not correspond in greater or lesser degree to the reality of that object. But yet, I say, I see, oh yes, I see the truth of that. I don't. As long as I, the subject, in my own consciousness, am separate from that object, I cannot really see the whole truth of that whole thing. For one thing, I, the subject, am in actual fact interrelated with the totality. That particular object is also interrelated and interacts with the totality. And one of the marvels of the latest scientific researches during the last 15 years is the complete proof, the scientific proof, that this is the case. That if the scientist wants to know the whole truth about any one thing, he has to explore and discover the whole truth about the totality. That's one of the wonderful things which science has done within the last 15 years. So now, to see in this deep sense, in this complete sense, means to see totally. But what does that mean for us? I put it in these terms. To see completely and wholly means to be that which you are seeing in mind and consciousness. Of course, you can't be that thing physically. If you or I look at a tree or a horse, we can't become that horse physically by seeing it in this profoundest sense that we can see. The seeing takes place in mind and consciousness. And then the separation, it is this separation, this isolativeness, which is the source of trouble and sorrow and so forth, that disappears. And in mind and consciousness, you are actually aware of, if I may so call it, the tree-ness of the tree, the horse-ness of the horse. In other words, that's something which is transcendentally the essence of it all, which is the essence of the totality, comes into your consciousness. So that seeing is a seeing by being it. You know how Plato put it? He said, he taught that you do not know anything in reality unless you can do it, unless you are so much at home with it, so completely in union, the true unio mystica, with it, that quite naturally and spontaneously, and as we would ordinarily say, unconsciously, you act and think and feel completely, truly in connection with it all the time. You make no mistake about it whatsoever. And this is something which comes in the course of man's development. So that we may consider as the true, the profound meaning of the word see. And the same applies to our hearing or touching or any of the other sense activities, including the ordinary thought process which takes place internally in our brains. When this takes place, then discriminative consciousness comes into closer relationship with universal consciousness, and our psychical turmoil, the stormy waves on the surface of the ocean, become perfectly quiet. And when they become quiet, and conscious and discriminative consciousness touches the peaceful realm underneath, the pure mind, then you experience something which transcends our ordinary mortal state. For the first time, you actually experience something of the meaning of immortality and of eternity. It lasts only for a time. And then, because it has not become our natural state permanently, but has still to be realized by constant mindfulness and observation. Because that hasn't yet happened, therefore, as we say, we fall back. And we wonder why that has happened. Oh, what a pity, I can't remain in that divine condition all the time. Well, of course I can't. Because in the psyche itself, there are still many obstructions. And it is those obstructions which we have to dissolve and enable the psyche to become perfectly transparent to the light of transcendence itself. And then there is no separation at any time. You will find all the great spiritual teachers of the world have affirmed this in their own particular way. What are the consequences for us when we do experience this kind of illumination from within? Our surface mind, I'm going to use the word mind here for convenience only, when the psyche is really calm, our surface mind is being in harmony with the pure mind. This psyche now acts like a shining mirror in which we see reflected the true nature of each and every form which we come across, which before we came across and regarded as a separate object, but now no longer separate. We are one with it in mind and consciousness. Then we see its true form externally in terms of shape and all the rest of it. And also we see, we sense, we are conscious of the archetypal form, the universal form, which complements any and every differentiated particular form. That is to say, we see the essence of the immortal and the eternal embodied in the finite, the particular, and the mortal, the perishable. Whoever experiences anything like this becomes a changed man. The true metanoia takes place, the transformation of the individual from being, to use Catholic terminology, the sinful human. He is transformed into the true human, the true Son of Man, which means the Son of Mind. Mind as the creative power, that is the meaning of the word man, comes from the Sanskrit root man, and the verb derived from that root manyate, which of course the dictionaries say means to think. But that's a very poor definition. And the dictionaries, remember, are made by people who are ordinary finite mortals and have not experienced this transcendental reality. Man, the root mind, is actually this creative activity of the primordial creative energy which releases cosmos into being. If, for instance, in the first chapter of Genesis, you were to translate it to this way, and don't say, "And God said, let there be light, and there was light." But if you say, "And God minded, let there be light," minded in this transcendental sense of the word mind, immediately there is light. It is the creative power. If you and I say, "Let there be light," there won't be light unless we have an electrical or other apparatus and we press a switch. But we can't say it. We can say it for the next 100 years and there'll be no light. You see? So, and God minded. Man, in his perfection, in his fulfillment, is the minder. And his minding creates. And in that creative process, there is the healing. Hence, some of the deep aspects of the healing miracles ascribed to all the spiritual teachers, the truly realized, perfected holy ones. So we see the archetypal form as well as the ordinary objective form. Now the archetypal subsumes the ordinary. Now I must explain this word subsumes. Take this box which is in front of me. It's a rectangular box. And we say that we can see its upper surface, its sides, and so forth. We can look at a solid three-dimensional box and say that that is a three-dimensional solid object. Now, we are conscious of this box in three-dimensional terms, and we are conscious of any surface connected with it in two-dimensional terms, length and breadth only. The box has length, breadth, and depth. We can touch it, we can hold it, and so forth, because it has length, breadth, and depth. But if you take a surface, and take it as a mathematician would, as a pure surface, it has length and breadth, but no thickness, no depth. You can't catch it. It is purely a mental concept. The brain is capable of conceiving it. If that surface were to move, livingly move, then three dimensions come into being and you've got a solid object. This solid object, three-dimensional solid object, subsumes every surface composing it in our imagination and so forth. You can't take a whole an infinite number of surfaces, put them together and produce a three-dimensional object. But any one surface capable of moving creatively, livingly, will produce the three-dimensional object. So the three-dimensional subsumes the two-dimensional, not merely contains it, like a box of oranges contains so many oranges. You can take, you can throw the oranges out and there is an empty box, you see. It's not like that. It is a creative activity. It's an extraordinary thing. And every limited, so-called separate thing and person is subsumed in that sense in the totality. That is why the universe is a universe. A one thing, unique. Now, that is one of the consequences of being able to see truly in the religious sense, in the transcendent sense. Another thing, we are conscious of ourselves in terms of separateness all along the line. I am so and so, my name, and I'm very conscious, very vividly conscious of myself. My whole mental process, or practically all my inner mental process, is concerned with myself. I live entirely self-concerned. The rest of the universe I call the not-self. Now look at the proportion. This tiny little infinitesimal, less than a grain of dust in the total cosmos, says I, and I am completely important to myself. The rest of the universe, oh yes, that's the not-self. That's the other thing. Now how can the human race, that is, the members of the human race, live in harmony if we are conscious of ourselves in that manner? We are very conscious of our own desires, ambitions, wishes, our difficulties, our sorrows, and all the rest of it. And the other person, and there are 4,000 million other persons on the face of the globe today, they also have their particular ambitions and desires and so forth, which can be very different from ours, and therefore there is perpetual conflict, not only within our own selves, but between man and man. But when discriminative consciousness enters the depths, which are no longer dark, but lightened up with this entry, then the situation becomes quite different. You become more aware of the totality in which you are subsumed, completely held. You know that wonderful sentence, and underneath are the everlasting arms. That becomes a realized fact in your life. Then one can begin to love in the true sense, unpossessively, undemandingly, unoppressively, unconcerned whether that love is returned or not returned. Then teachings like love your enemies, or the teaching that hatred never ceases by a counter blast of hatred, but only by love. You can't order that love. You can't command that love. When it is a natural part and parcel of yourself, then it operates as the perfect healer, and it casts out fear. So we get free of this illusion of the separate self. We are not separate selves. That is to say, we are not isolated, completely isolated from anyone else. We are a living whole, the total cosmos. It is this isolatedness that moves out of our self-consciousness. We have to have self-consciousness, otherwise we cannot even walk from here to there in the right way. We might barge into a motor car, and I'm afraid the motor car won't get so hurt as we would. See, so self-consciousness has to be there. But the isolativeness, that which cuts us off as completely separate individuals, is dissolved. And then that canker, that poison of selfishness, of selfness, that poison is not thrown out or discarded, it is transformed into the nectar of immortality, the realization of immortality, which means the realization of the unity of the universe. And it is there consciously, it is there permanently in your discriminative consciousness. Now it is possible for wisdom to grow. See clearly that wisdom is a faculty of the living, pure mind embodied in us, formless, shapeless, not functioning in terms of mental constructs produced in the brain, just separate mental pictures and mental forms which become rigid and fossilized, and these are the things which obstruct the psyche most. Our ordinary concepts and fixed ideas are our mental card index. Now these concepts, this mental card index, has a purpose, a usefulness. It is this collection of concepts which enables us to structure the immediate percept. Now just go back in imagination to the days after you were born. Can you remember how you stare at anything? You don't know what it is. It's completely new. We are ignorant. What is this? What is that? I don't know. I see it a second time. Still I don't know. A hundredth time. Still I don't know. Perhaps a thousandth time, and because Mama keeps saying, "Oh, this is Mum, darling," then finally that sound, Mum, becomes associated with a mental picture which has impressed itself in the brain. It has now become a concept, your one of the cards in your mental card index. So next time you see Mum, you say, "Oh yes, that's Mum." But note the difference. When you first looked at Mum, and you were in this state of amazement, if you were hungry, you instinctively sort of moved towards Mum and wanted to suckle her breast. You didn't know what you were doing. There was no mental construct yet about it, but you did it spontaneously. If you were not hungry, Mum would still be something quite strange. Until the concept was formed, until the mental picture became fixed, and then the sound, language is a system of symbolical sounds to make one recognize whatsoever we experience, to cognize again, to know again. You get the idea? So that's where the concept becomes necessary. To enable us to recognize. But there is a very unfortunate aspect to it. When we recognize the object, we dismiss the actual perceiving in the immediate moment. Oh, that's a tree there. That is finished. I don't look at it anymore. But if I do not look at it anymore and dismiss it out of my mind, I have insulted that tree. I am not in harmony with it. I am not in union with it, in mind and consciousness. The perceiving is the living process. The conceiving, that is to say, the thought process, is just a mechanizing process, a deadening activity. It is useful for recognizing, that is all, and structuring. But you see, when one grows inwardly, then one knows what to do with the concepts and how to utilize them in the living act of perceiving now, which is the actual human process. These are very important things to realize. So we can see the difference between wisdom and knowledge. When wisdom functions, then pure intelligence is active from within ourselves and sees the truth of all that is actually present now, the living perceiving, with unerring insight. Wisdom makes no mistakes. Such wisdom, a divine faculty, such intelligence and archetypal power makes no mistakes whatever. We should avoid mistaking intuition for wisdom or pure intelligence. Intuition can and does make mistakes. When intuition happens to be right, it is because that particular intuition is rooted in and in perfect harmony with wisdom. That happens sometimes. So your intuitions are true. But intuitions can mislead just as easily as misperceptions. But wisdom never makes a mistake. It sees with unerring insight. We can see then that wisdom, a living faculty or power, grows from within our living being. If it grows from within our living being, it cannot be acquired from others. No other person can ever make you wise. It is something which grows from within. Wisdom cannot be taught. By contrast, knowledge is acquired. Knowledge is a gathering of information, bits of information, so many mental pictures, mental fossils more or less, put together. That's our knowledge, our acquired, which we acquire from the external world and also by restricted brain activity, musing about it. And when we muse like that and we say we think about it, all we are doing is churning up our card index, our mental card index, and rearranging it in a different way. So we get different mental shapes. And this is the knowledge which we can acquire from outside. Knowledge can be handed over by one person to another, particularly where a particular skill is concerned. You can hand that over to another. Do it like this, act like that, and so on and so on, and this is what will be the result. So that can be acquired. It can also be taught, it can be sought, it can be found, and stored. And stored. Knowledge can be stored. You can't store wisdom. It's a living process, a living function. The activity of the heart, for instance, the movement of the blood. You can't store that. It just goes on, the life process. It's a mystery, actually. Howsoever deeply scientists may investigate and discover the mechanism of it, but you can't store it. But just as a storehouse can only contain objects or food, but cannot grow fruit or grain which sustains and nourishes us, knowledge cannot, but wisdom does sustain and nourish our inner spiritual life. So you see, spiritual growth, the real coming to fruition of man, is not dependent upon knowledge. Knowledge can help in a very minor degree, but we have always exaggerated the importance of knowledge. It is this thing, wisdom, which nourishes and sustains. It's the living process, and it can only come from within yourself, because it is a faculty of your living being. How can anybody else hand over a faculty of your living being to you? It's not possible. And then there is freedom when wisdom functions. And the free consciousness of that man affects and changes the consciousness of others who come within the range of his free consciousness. We all know from experience, sometime, somewhere, that in the presence of a certain person, we are in a different world. We are uplifted. We are in a transcendent state. We just touch that transcendent state. And we never slip back from that transcendent state, because it is a real transformation of consciousness itself.